welcome one, welcome all, step right up, step right up, ladies and gentlemen, Portal Gaming Podcast, episode number 176, the PAX Unplugged Car Ride Recap is here. Howdy, everybody. Portal Game Podcast, a podcast brought to you by a store called The Portal, which is located in Manchester, Connecticut. And for more information, you can log on to www.theportalct.com. Check us out on Facebook, The Portal, and on Twitter, at PortalGaming60. Also, our YouTube channel, Step Into The Portal. That is where you will find us streaming, unboxing, and other live content. Howdy, everybody. My name is The Brant. I am the host for this episode of The Portal Gaming Podcast, which is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. And we are here in the car ride on the way home from PAX Unplugged 2021. I am not alone. Sometimes it's one of me. Now it is four of us. So with us in the car is Kathy.
Hello.
And Brian.
Hello, a non-media member.
And special guest for the episode, because he has no choice, he's trapped in the car with us, Eric Sommer from the Dice Tower Podcast.
Hello, help, they've trapped me in this car and they're making me record a podcast.
Oh, Eric, watch out for those boxes hitting you in the head.
They're beating me with copies of Unmatched.
So, yeah, we're driving home, we're actually like on the Connecticut-New York border, so we've made our drive home. It's not very far. For us, this is basically our local convention in terms of big conventions. So I think I'll just get people's kind of like reaction as to the convention as a whole, the experience, all those kind of things. Brian, you can go first.
Yeah, no, it was great to be back at everything. And it felt like it was operating pretty smoothly, especially like after a long hiatus for anything like this. So I guess we kind of got a taste of like what this was going to be looking like with Gen Con, but I don't. They did a really good job getting this organized, and it was good to see people again. So
nice, Kath. How did you feel about the convention?
It was good. This is the first time I've been around this many people in all of the time of COVID. So I needed more downtime this time than normal, I think. But it was fun. I got to play a bunch of games and hang out with you guys, so that was good.
I feel like PAX Unplugged is actually a really good, like, big convention for getting downtime. It's not too far to walk anywhere. It's pretty easy to get in and out of.
Yeah, I agree. And it was nice having an Airbnb because you guys would all just leave in the morning and I had the place to myself and got to hang out and have, like, quiet, which was actually more quiet than I would have gotten at home. So it was kind of like a little vacation. And then come play games in the afternoon and at night. So, yeah, it was good.
All right, Eric, what was your take?
PAX is sort of the model for how to do a convention. They really know their stuff. The enforcers are like the volunteers, although I think it's a paid position for PAX. I'm not sure. The purple-shirted people running things are just top-notch. They always do a fantastic job. There was an extra layer of health screening that went into this event, and they were so efficient, just dealing with the line, checking vaccination status, metal detectors and stuff that the convention center had to have them do. It was so well run. I saw nothing but happy retailers and exhibitors and stuff. But I agree with what Kathy said. It was, I think, more exhausting than I expected it to be. First time being around this many people in a long time, first major event for me. And while a lot of it felt familiar and welcome and delightful to get to see people again, it was, I felt like I was drained earlier in the day than I normally am. And maybe that's just being out of practice with this sort of thing, because, you know, conventions can be a pretty intense experience. Or maybe it's just that there's that extra layer of health issues. People were masked the whole time, having to speak through a mask in order to be heard and understood. There was that extra layer of exhaustion and stress that came into it. So downtime was important for this event.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's a good one. It's, you know, it's definitely, like, it's hard to... crowded is a weird term because we've all been in places that are just like a concert where it's people on top of you and there's nothing you can do, right? But this was definitely busy. It was a lot of people in there. But it was just so great to see. It didn't feel like the numbers of, like, attendees was way up, but the number of maybe people I know and work with, content creators and publishers and designers and even just people from Connecticut. There was a lot of a lot of them there. And it was just so good to see people. Because like Brian said, we went to Gen Con, and it was kind of like you waved to everybody. And it wasn't like so business, but it was basically all business. Like, we're here to do Gen Con and sell items and keep this going. But this felt like it was, like, friendly. Like, I was able to see so many people. It was great to see, like, everybody from This Game Is Broken. And Crystal was there, and we saw Suze in one of the booths, and I saw James Hudson, and I saw my roommate from college, Andrew Smith, and just lots and lots of people that I got to see and interact with, and that was just such a great part of the convention, and it just felt like, I don't know, like we're doing this, we're getting back together again, and we get to see everybody. So certainly we'll talk about games and things like that, but I thought that was an important part of it. I love this convention because it's close to us, so it just feels like we can zip down there and zip back in terms of travel. I don't know, maybe everybody's feeling different now that we're like an hour something away from home and ready to be done.
Zip is an interesting word after the hour traffic.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we hit traffic both ways because that's how New Jersey is, so go through there. We'll run through some games played, but basically we came down Thursday night. Kathy did an amazing job getting us right into a parking spot that happened to be right next to our building.
That was well done. Well timed.
Thank you. It was an accident, but it worked out.
No, yeah. We didn't get into an accident.
No, it was a happy accident.
Happy accidents right here. And then we got all our luggage and kind of checked in quick because it was just an Airbnb, so it's basically just get in. And Eric and Brian and I headed over to Stephen Bonacor and Rachel Blaski's event where they have like a networking meetup. And I actually think we got there at a good time. People said it was like really crowded 2 hours before that. And we got there for the last hour and it was actually great. It felt like I got to see a lot of people and it wasn't crazy out of control, but like big props to them for putting that on. I think that was a great way for everybody who's been dying to see each other to get to see each other.
True, but it was pretty packed. Even though we were there at the tail end of things, there were still a lot of people, and probably the most crowded of anything that we did at PAX was that industry event in the evening. So I'm glad that it was a quick visit and not a giant crush of people at the beginning of it.
Anything on that, Brian?
No, I mean, yeah, it was good to like be a part of it. Definitely not my scene as much, but I was happy to have gone.
Yeah, I think I gave Matthew Jude 7 hugs. I was so excited to see him. I haven't seen him in forever, so.
And then you lost your hat.
Oh, I lost my hat. That became a saga for the weekend. Trying to get my hat, but I got my hat back. You got to get your hat back.
The hat came back. The very next day.
Oh, there it is.
That was you? You found out that happened? Or how did... I don't even know how it actually...
So we tried to go back and get my hat, and they didn't... Like, the guy checked, so I don't want to say they didn't, but it seemed like somebody had cleaned up prior. And then it was on Facebook, right? They posted that they had some leftover items, and Eric saw it.
Oh, for the event.
Let them know.
Yeah, for the event, they specifically posted.
Probably caught it. We just didn't see it on Facebook until later when we went to try and get the hat at the hotel. So, yeah, they figured out that it was Brant's and got it back to him, and the hat's coming home to Connecticut.
Yes, it's coming home with us. So, I think then, did we play the crew that first night?
Yeah.
Okay. That was our goal. And we went... This is the best crew I have ever had for the crew. We did, so this is Mission Deep Sea, the new version of the crew, and we went 10 for 10 in the first 10 missions of the game. And it was great. It was amazing. No errors, no argument. I think Kathy was the captain 8 out of the 10 times.
At least the first 5.
Nice, yeah. And I still made some of my risky moves, and they paid off, so nobody was upset with me. Otherwise, there might have been a few more losses, a few more arguments there. But yeah, that new crew, I don't know. There's not much to say. It's like, if you like the crew, you'll like this better, and if you haven't played it yet, you can jump in on number two. I think it's just a better place to jump in.
It's better for replay, for sure, because the missions are random. Yeah. So they get more complex. The difficulty goes up, but it is not the same sequence of missions. And so you can start it over with a new group and still be challenged by the individual missions because they come up in a random order.
Yeah, it's pretty much a perfect game for like a Christmas stocking stuffer, right? Like price-wise, almost size-wise. It seems great. Like, I don't know. Everybody's holiday celebrations are different, I guess. But typically mine end with, like, everybody's just kind of done and you're still sitting around the place because you want to see family. So you kind of naturally move into that, like, we're sitting around talking on couches or people are sitting at a dining room table where you could take this out and play with people, especially if they're accustomed to trick-taking, which is pretty, you know, it's a pretty wide swath of people that have played trick-taking games before.
Yeah, I feel like 3 and 4 players are kind of where it's, at least from the previous version, that's kind of where it felt like it shined the best. But, I mean, that worked out for us, right? Like, you know, with the 4 of us playing through, it was just a great time.
I think the trickiest part is that you want to keep your group through all the missions. So you have to find the group that will regularly enough get together to be able to play through all the missions.
Yes. No, yeah, I agree. Yeah, you got to figure out where, yeah, you kind of create a meta with your group a bit.
Right. You don't have to.
In some ways, it kind of feels like you're learning a new form of communication, right? Like, you're just figuring out how to convey information any way that you can within the limitations of the structure, which is cool.
You're also learning the play styles of the various groups. I'm sure, you know, if some people are more aggressive or have a particular... If someone plays, communicates a certain card, that can mean one thing or another based on the personality of that player. And learning those tricks of your group is part of the adventure.
Nice. So then we got to the first morning of the convention, and we got up early. And we went over, we were not looking forward to waiting in a line, but we thought that it would be a line for vaccination status check, media badge check, getting in. So we went over early and that was smooth sailing.
Oh yes. We were so early they weren't even open yet, getting breakfast and getting the line squared away, and we were just in and out of there so fast that we didn't know what to do with ourselves. I was used to running a booth for the Dice Tower, and without that task to take care of, it was a little bit of hurry up and wait for the early portion of the day.
Yeah, so that first morning, we sat down, and Eric had a puzzle. What is it? Wish You Were Here,
it's called. It's not really an escape room, but a puzzle series that's based on postcards. And it's one that I've had in my travel bag for a long time, and I pulled it out and said, I only got like halfway through one puzzle on this. Can you guys help me? And we solved some things. We didn't solve the whole thing, but we uncovered a whole bunch of secret clues. We know there's a conspiracy afoot. I just don't know what to do with that information.
Yeah, Brian, you like were crushing that.
Yeah, no, it was cool just to once you got into the thinking, like, into the way that they're trying to make you think, it was fun to explore that.
It was sort of like you discover what the pattern is.
Yeah.
I we won't spoil what that revelation was, but we would say, hey, wait, is this what this means? And then as you start to decode that and follow that path and words start to form as you're discovering, it's like, yes, I'm on the right track. What is this secret message? That was fun.
Nice. So then the convention opened. It was pretty smooth. Like, we just went downstairs. I didn't realize it, but they opened the doors 5 minutes early, which is what a lot of conventions did this year. When they felt like people were congregating outside, they just kind of opened the doors so that there wasn't a lot of congregating.
Huh. I didn't realize they did that.
And it wasn't a massive rush in there. There was there were definitely a lot of people. The publishers that I talked to, which was about... Well, I talked to a lot of publishers. The ones I probably talked about the convention with more, I would say maybe three or four booths, they were saying how it felt like 10 to noon was quiet every day. And then it was almost like people finished lunch, and then they wanted to come over. So it felt like they maybe had some events in the morning, lunch, and then they were really starting to come over. And they said, actually, unlike other conventions, the last hour felt really busy at this one. Like, people were kind of waiting, as opposed to, like, a Gen Con where it's the first hour that's out of control. So they said that was kind of an interesting change.
You think that's a buying strategy? Like, I don't want to carry this package of games around all day. If the danger of things selling out isn't there, people can take their time exploring their purchases. Oh, I'll consider this, I'll consider that. And then in the last couple of hours, they go and actually spend the money and start carrying boxes around so that they can then leave and not have to haul it around all day.
Yeah, that would make sense. That's probably something to relate it to what it is. So I got a chance to meet Michael Kelly and Peter Gusis from One Stop Co-op Shop, which is fun because I've actually streamed with Peter doing Marvel Champions, so it was good to meet him in person. There were so many people that it always stinks when you're trying to remember the people that you saw, and then you can't, and you feel bad. So,
yep.
But I do remember meeting them, and that was fun. Actually, later we got a picture with somebody who watches both of us play Marvel Champions, and that was just neat to do that. So, there was that piece. Eric, we'll have you go in a second, but I think we sat down to play Botoku.
Yeah, I mean, the two of us played Canopy first, and then the three. Excluding Eric, we sat down and played Botoku.
I had meetings all day. You three did your own thing.
That's a good call, Eric. Yes. Go ahead, Brian. Tell us about Canopy.
It was just a pretty fast to play two-player kind of card drafting of sorts. Not necessarily in the like normal drafting way, but you're building up a tableau and, you know, growing trees, collecting wildlife, and trying to avoid these penalties that could come upon you. It played pretty smoothly. It was, you know, it was good to break it out and give it a try, you know. I don't know what your thoughts on it were, Brian.
Yeah, I agree. It was neat. It's just very much in this vein of nature-themed games, and the you know, the art is great. And that, like, drafting mechanism, it's got three piles. You draw one, you look at it, you decide if you want to keep a card. And if you want to, you keep a card from there, and that's the end of your turn. Otherwise, you add a card to that stack, look at the next stack, so it's got that kind of piece. But other than that, the point scoring and things, it just... Yeah, it was something that, for me, would seem tough to play over and over again. But it was fun. Like, that's the thing. There's so many games now that are fun. Like, it's never like somebody would say, oh, did you enjoy this? It's like, oh, I definitely enjoyed it. You know, what I... do repeat plays of it, I don't know. So that's an interesting spot. But at least we're at the point where, like, almost all games are fun, right? Like, yeah. That's always a nice part. And I love seeing the nature theme in games. Like, yeah, it's a little overdone, but at least nature feels like, you know, there's this section of animals, there's plants, there's outer space, there's just so many... water. Like, there's so many places to be, so I enjoy that a whole bunch.
There's no way there's more nature games than space games.
No, but in the recent years, well, probably still not in the recent years, right? But nature, weirdly, has become a more popular, like, it just feels like nature should be in theme all along.
Nature is having a moment.
Nature is having a moment.
I'm here for it.
Nice. All right, so then we played Botoku, and this is a big, sprawling Euro game from Devir, and I don't know the designer. I'm not going to go through the game, but we sat, read the rules. There were some people that were helping us out. They definitely knew the rules, but there's some little intricate pieces of this game. So it was a lot to get through and a lot to convey. That's always one of my... I enjoy it. I enjoy reading the rule book and interpreting it, but it's hard at a convention like that with a lot of people talking around you to make sure you convey all those rules. But it's themed that this great spirit... is going to die, going to go to the great ascending, and you are these like minor spirits, and one of you is going to take the great spirit's place. And so you're gathering, are they yokai or yoki?
Yokai.
yokai. You're gathering yokai, and they are cards, and you're playing them to these slots to unlock these dice, which would then become a worker placement game. And once you place them, they can then go across the river by decreasing to gain other yokai, to gain paths that you can move across. And then meanwhile, you are waking up your pilgrims by doing various things and gathering crystals, and then you want your pilgrims to take the path of wisdom and enlightenment to kind of create this. There's so many other elements to the game that it just, this is not a place to cover all that.
It's a busy board.
Yeah, it'll give you all those things. And it's definitely open. It's left open, which I know for Brian and Kathy sometime, well, I'm putting words in your mouth, so I'll be quiet on that. But it was left open. I really, really enjoyed this game. And I know Eric got a chance to play it at Dice Tower Retreat. So we'll go around and get some thoughts on Butoku. Eric, why don't you jump in first?
Well, I mean, it's a really neat system with that unlocking of the dice and then the moving of the dice. And you have to spend actions and resources to improve those dice, because every time you have them cross the river, they go down by one. And so but then when you retrieve them at the end of the round, they don't re-roll or increase, so you have to keep charging them up to keep them viable from round to round. And that's an interesting economy that is unlike anything else I've played, but it is a very busy system. There's a lot of options, and it's almost one of those analysis paralysis prone menus of items that you have in front of you. You have lots of options when you first begin the game, and figuring out a strategy at first is a little tricky.
Yeah, I feel like a little bit, at least for me, felt like the beginning of the game I was fighting against the current, in a sense. Like, a lot of the ways I would have interpreted either the icons or the rules or how the flow would be, like, basically whenever I interpreted something, I was incorrect in my assumption. So that was probably where my barrier was. Like, it didn't feel like it kind of was operating on all cylinders in a way. So, but I did enjoy it, and I'd love to play it again soon. So,
yeah,
I didn't like it as much when I was playing it. It started out okay, and then I just got to a place where I got stuck, and that was frustrating. And there were also several rules I didn't understand, or like the scoring I didn't fully grasp. So then by the time we got to the end, I was like, oh, I had this whole thing I could have done, but I didn't even realize that was a thing. So I would want to play it again in a time where there was less going on around me, certainly. And now that I have a better idea of how it all works. But what you were saying, Brant, earlier about they're not, like, when there are a lot of paths to take, I want something to give me a reason to pick a path. And that was harder to find for me in this game. So it was, yeah, when I have a lot of decisions, I shut down a little bit. So, yeah, I think playing it again, I would have a better idea of whether it was a game I actually liked or not.
Yeah, I think that's the key walk away or takeaway from us playing a first time, you know, with kind of giving that initial impression, is that I'm pretty sure everybody would say they want to play again.
Yeah.
So, in my mind, that's a, like, a, we think we enjoyed it, we may not enjoy it, we're not sure where it would be. So, for kind of people listening in and like, ooh, I'm interested in Butoku, it's probably a try before you buy if you can find a place to do that. And we'll see over, you know, multiple plays as kind of that busyness comes down, right, to a more understandable level. Where's the game at in terms of all that? But definitely a nice, unique theme that we're not seeing, and a gorgeous production. So that's nice to see in these heavy strategy games, for sure. Eric, you did a bunch of meetings. You saw the Jurassic, well, whatever you want to talk about, but I know you saw the Jurassic World game, so I'm going to, like, hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
Sure, yes. Well, that was one of the things I got to see was Jurassic World, the Legacy of Isla Nublar, which is upcoming from Funko Games / Prospero Hall. It is a Legacy-style game that has, I believe, 12 adventures. There's a tutorial, 10 regular adventures, and a finale adventure that will result in a replayable game where you've built up Isla Nublar to be a Jurassic Park. And there's minis, dinosaur minis to unlock. There's comic books for each chapter of the adventure. There's different characters that have unlockable abilities. And, oh, I mean, there is a ton of stuff in here. And it better have a ton of stuff because it has a $120 price tag. That's a lot for a legacy game. So I do appreciate that there is a replayable, you know, you've made the park. It is interesting that no matter what the results of any particular play session, once you've passed the tutorial, which is playable as many times as you want, once you've moved into the legacy segment, win or lose, you move forward. So you have to deal with the consequences of everything you do, and that includes failure in the missions. So you might end up with a park that you have not done well maintaining in the final version. I'm sure there are ways to mitigate all of that, and I trust that they've designed this to be replayable when you're done. But there's a lot in that box. The question is going to be, are gamers willing to spend that much money on the legacy game? And I think they might be willing to do it. The other meeting I had was seeing Jerry Hawthorne's new game, Familiar Tales, which is his new storybook game. There's a new name for it, and I'm blanking on it now. Story crafting? I think that's what it is. Story crafting game. This is a deck builder, cooperative deck builder, where you're acquiring cards into your deck to take actions and do cool stuff. All four of the characters in this game are playable every time you play. So whether you're playing it as a solo or as a two-player or four-player, you combine decks in order to operate multiple characters. There are story elements that use an app with full narration. There are characters. You've got, like, named actors playing these different parts. It's really been treated like a radio drama or an interactive storybook. Very cool. I'm very excited. I only got to play through the first page or so of the adventure, but I'm really looking forward to playing this with my kids. My youngest has already picked out his favorite character.
Wow. Nice. I don't think we played anything else in the afternoon, but Toku kind of really took a lot out of us, right?
Yeah, that was the bulk of it.
So then we did dinner, and then we headed over to Home 2?
Yep.
All right. So we went over to Home 2, which is the Hilton across the street, and met a bunch of people, and we played Mike and Peter's new Mega Man game.
Adventures.
And that's, so Mega Man Adventures is from Blacklist Games. That'll be coming out, so we'll worry about kind of talking that. That was more to be able to play with Peter, meeting him for the first time. So we were playing his prototype version, so we'll wait till that comes out to talk more about that. And then, did we play Lost Ruins?
Yeah.
All right. So then we played the Lost Ruins of Arnak with the Expedition Leaders expansion. I know for me, kind of, there was always the debate between, like, Dune Imperium and Lost Ruins of Arnak, and I definitely think after playing both several times, I like Lost Ruins of Arnak better. That doesn't mean Dune Imperium is a bad game in my mind. Like, they're both fun. I'll sit down and play them anytime, but Lost Ruins, I'm, like, a little more excited. And the expansion, to me, was phenomenal. It's a no-brainer add-in every time. It was really fun. We played with Steve, and we played with Isaac Childress, who we got a chance to play with at Gen Con as well.
He's famous.
Yeah, he designed, like, Gloomhaven, which is on
Steve.
Board Game Geek.
Steve.
Steve. I don't remember Steve. I don't think there's anything to say. Does sound rude. I mean it that way. So, Brian, why don't you run us through some of your some of the expansion and what you thought about that? Because Kathy, you haven't played it.
No.
And Eric, you haven't played it.
Mm-mm.
But we all acquired copies of it. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, it's cool because every player is going to start off with a completely different player power. So you're going to have incentives to try to do specific things based on what your character's abilities are, or, you know, so, like, the player boards are going to be different. You're going to have different pieces that are unique to your character as well. So it really changes up like what your personal puzzle is and kind of dictates how to like how you can progress through the game. So it was really fun. I know part of the joy, like, it's the joy in like experimenting with a new character and trying to see like how that works. I wouldn't necessarily say it's like it's a no-brainer to add in, but I wouldn't say that everyone that's playing the game should play with this. Like the base game itself is just going to give you a very cool puzzle, but like you're all playing at the same, I don't know, like it sounds bad to say a level playing field, but do you kind of know what I mean? Like everyone's kind of doing the system the same way, whereas this makes it so you're kind of playing a little bit of a tweak on that, which is cool. So
yeah, I know what you're saying. I think the reason I disagree is because asymmetric powers is my favorite mechanism in games. Hence Gaia Project, hence Root, those types of games that I enjoy so much. I would say, you know, if you happen to be playing the game without me, boy, that sounds so arrogant. But, you know, you're playing it and you would hesitate to teach those characters or worry about are other people understanding those characters. But, I mean, each one comes with a cheat sheet that tells you that, all the new icons. They didn't seem bad. I would throw it in every time, but if you don't want to do that, you can play with Brian.
No, so. I mean, if people had played the game before, like, then, I just added it in.
So the first play.
Like, the first play feels like it might be a little much, depending on who you're playing with. But if people are willing to just say, like, yeah, I want to play with variable player powers, then, yeah, it just added in.
Yeah, so the characters, I'm trying to remember, there was, like, I played the Explorer, and I only had one worker to place, but I could move my worker around to multiple places. I also had cards, like, different cards that I could trigger to do spaces that people were already on. And I got bonuses for, like, digging up those sites. I could look at two tiles and pick what I wanted to. Isaac was playing, like, an investor, so he just kept getting money. He just amassed cards, and he had a card that was always in his hand that he could always use every turn. It kept coming back to him. Yeah. Steve was playing with, like, a mystic or something who wanted to acquire fear cards and then could do a ritual to expound those fear cards to gain bonuses.
Wow.
So he was gaining tons of fear cards, and I'll let Brian explain his.
Oh, and I had a bird, maybe a hawk. I forget exactly what it was. But basically, the bird would move forward a step on its own track every round. And there were other ways that I could make it move a little faster. And the longer I waited for it to move along that track, I could just slide it back to square one and gain the benefit where the hawk is. So you kind of slide it up, get the benefit. Like, so if you need something immediately, great. If you wait a little longer, you're going to get a better benefit. So it was just a neat system to try to figure out, like, how do I let it go long enough for me to gain the best benefit for me?
Nice. So yeah, that was Lost Ruins of Arnak, and then I think it was the next day.
Yeah. More or less, yeah.
I assume the two of you were both looking forward to Lost Ruins. I don't know if there's anything you want to say.
No, I
given that you have not played it.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, we all picked up copies, so that's going to be really exciting. And I'll run through some of that on the Step Into the Portal channel, and we'll cover it on the podcast again. I don't know. Maybe we won't cover it again. We just covered it. So then the next morning, Eric and I headed out early, and we played Food Chain Island.
Food Chain Island is a single player, so we sort of played it cooperatively, solo game from Scott Alms and Button Shy Games. You have a grid of animal cards numbered 0 through 15, and each of those animals can eat the lower three numbers in sequence. So, say, the 11 can eat the 10, 9, and 8. And you're trying to eat them. You can move on your turn one of these animals orthogonally to eat the animal that it jumps onto, and then you must trigger that animal's special power. So it's not just, well, can I get the 6 to land on the 4 and then can move it here? It's that, but it's also, after I do that, well, now I have to swap two animals. How am I going to do that? How can I leverage these powers in a way that's going to work for me to ultimately get them down to one, two, or three animals left. And we made it down to two animals on this first play, which is called the unintentional matchmaker level of winning the game. It was cute. I picked this up at the Button Shy booth. I picked up four different of the wallet games as just sort of trying them out. I like Scott Alms as a designer, and this one seems like a fun puzzle.
Yeah, that was neat. And we learned it together, two players. And I've learned a lot of solo games with two people, and learning a solo game with two people, I'm actually finding pretty enjoyable. Once I know it, it's not sure. Like you want to make the decisions yourself, but learning it kind of, it's a way to bounce ideas off. So
it's easier to struggle through the rules when you're doing it that way.
Yeah, so that was good. And then the convention opened, and I'm trying to remember, I'm actually wondering, do I need to backtrack? We played Stella. Was that this day?
Yeah, that was this day.
Oh, perfect. Kathy, do you want to explain Stella? Because I think it was one of your favorite games of the convention. If you don't want to explain, I can explain. You can talk about it.
You can explain
it. All right. So Stella is in the Dixit universe. Eric, have you heard of this one?
Yes, I played it.
Oh, there you go. So it's in the Dixit universe, so it's got all those Dixit cards, as they're now called. And you lay out a grid, a 3x5 grid. That's three rows and five columns, Brian. Okay. And then you get a random word, and that word is placed. Oh, we've got the bridge that we have to hold our breath. So you get the word, and then everybody looks at those cards, and you've got a little tile that you mark off of the 15 cards. Which ones do you think remind you of that word? So I think our first word was vitamin, and we were looking for cards that, you know, made us think of the word vitamin. And then you kind of place your token out with 1 to 10 cards was the range that you had to put them in. And then one person is the scout, and they start saying a card that they thought that they think everybody else has kind of got that Scattergories feel, except you want to match up with other players. And so then people say, yep, I matched, and you get points, and you're trying to match at different systems, and we'll be back in 10 seconds. So
you're really going to leave
it in? I totally am going to leave it in. So if you're wondering why there's a 10-second dead space, it's because in Hamden, Connecticut, there is a tunnel that goes under a mountain, and we hold our breath under the tunnel, and I think it's funny. So, Brian, this is the autonomy you have now, the power you have now leveraged my way with this podcast.
Goodness. I'm sorry, everyone.
So, yeah, so Stella, what you want to do is if you match with only one other person, you each get 3 points. If you match with multiple people, everybody gets 2 points. So you want to actually just match with one person. But if you pick a card and nobody matched, then you're out. And you can't score any more points that round. It keeps going to other people. Also, if you selected the highest amount of cards, then you get -1 point every time points are scored. So you don't want to go overboard on the cards that you're looking towards on that front. But, Kathy, we're going to have you talk about this one first because this was something you really enjoyed. You said, I want to buy this game. Let's go get this game. And then Brian let you down.
I did like this game, mostly because I just love the art on the cards. It's very...
the star, looking at the star map.
Fantastical and... just beautiful and adorable and funny and quirky. There's a little snail holding a flag looking out the window. I don't know. They were just really... I love the art for the game, so that was fun.
Awesome. Other takes on Stella?
It's a neat twist on the Dixit concept, to take these cards that we're so familiar with in Dixit form and sort of approach them in a different way. It's kind of neat. I like it. It was a nice surprise. I didn't know it existed until I got a chance to play it.
Yeah, no, I'm happy. Like, anytime there's a new Dixit expansion or like anytime there's more artwork to add to any of the games that are in that setting, like, it's awesome to get more stuff like that. And yeah, the game was really cool. It was fun to play and just kind of figure out how to, like, how to play that system in a way. Like, it wasn't, like, the... It wasn't the normal way that you kind of think through, like, how you're doing a grid like that and picking cards and all that sort of... Like, it was fun to play, and it's a cool twist with the same cards that, you know, Dixit has so many expansions out there as well. So just having another option to use those cards with is great.
Yeah, I just think it's so whimsical. Like, even when people don't pick your card... Or when two of you do and other people don't, and then you get to, like, explain, like, of course it's this card. Oh, I saw the same thing you did. Or nobody saw that, like, and even though you know, oh, I get no more points and there should be that letdown, like, competition-wise, you're kind of excited to, like, tell people, like, oh, make this connection that I made, right? And so it's, like, the points definitely matter in this game. I wouldn't say it's like those games where we totally remove the points, but I think there's just that joy of matching up the cards, with the words. Now I'm discombobulated as to where we are and which day. Are there other games? I know what we played that night. Is there something else we should talk about, or Eric, something you played during the day Saturday?
Well, I spent a good amount of time in the classic cardboard section. Oh, yeah. Our good friend Flip Flory was doing his tournament of Cheezampions, where they were playing a bunch of classics like Heartthrob and Don't Tip the Waiter and a bunch of silliness. But while we were there, I sat down to play 13 Dead End Drive, which is a game from the 90s, I think, that I had never actually played before. It's either 13 Dead End Drive or 1313 Dead End Drive, depending on which version you get. This has this huge 3D mansion with traps and stuff, and you are an heir to this fortune, and you're trying to secretly get your character to inherit the fortune while bumping off the ones that are not you. It's got statue, like a plastic statue that can fall over, and a chandelier that can crash down, and people can get thrown off stairs. It's ridiculous, but a good time. And another one from 1974 called The Inventors, which has the strangest dice tower I've ever seen. 1974, Parker Brothers. It's this plastic device you stick dice in and hit a plunger and it rings a bell and rolls the dice. Meanwhile, you're getting inventions and you can add patent claims to these inventions, which increase how much they're worth by sticking the card into this machine and then pulling it out, and it's got a metal clip on it. It, for 1974, it is elaborate and cute. It's not a great game, but it was an interesting experience playing The Inventors.
Nice. Wow. That sounds interesting. Yeah, I don't think I've ever played 13 Dead End Drive, but I remember people having it, like friends. So I don't know if
There's
I played that.
There's apparently an anniversary edition that came out fairly recently.
Got it. All right. I know there were a few other things played. I feel like, for sake of time, I want to cover Corrosion. I want to cover 1923 Cotton Club and Scout. Is there anything else?
We played Merchants of the Dark Road.
Oh, and Merchants of the Dark Road. All right. All right, here we go. So we played Merchants of the Dark Road. This is from Elf Creek Games.
Yep.
And you are merchants, and you're trying to acquire goods. You're trying to, like, sell those goods to heroes who will join your traveling cart. What would it be called?
Wagon.
Yeah, your wagon. And then eventually you can go on this journey into this dark land, where you can bring the heroes where they want to be, their homes, whatever it might be, and you can kind of, like, fulfill these commissions from the queen, and you have to go on this presumably dangerous journey. People can join you along the way, and the game is run by a dice system, these dice that have 0 to 4 pips on them. You roll them kind of into your wagon wheel, and then you push other dice out, and the number of pips is how far you move along a rondel, a 5-point rondel. And then you can trigger the actions on the spaces that are around those, one of the spaces, unless you get the illumination die. And the end game scoring is you're gaining prestige for doing various things, but you're also trying to sell things to acquire coins. And the lower of those two, so the lower of your kind of victory points and your coins, is your base score, and then any cards you acquire that give victory points beyond that, of which there's very few. which Jeremy Howard came over, saw us playing. This is one of his favorite games, I know. And he informed us, like, don't anticipate a lot of victory points coming out. Like, it's mostly getting those coins and things. So that was actually a good heads up for us, I thought. Yeah, that's kind of how you go through that game. I thought it was pretty good. I thought that part where you go into the Dark Lands, like, there were all these steps. But once we did it, it was very clear what you were going to do. You could choose to take a shortcut, and that was kind of a weird element of the game. I know, like, I liked Butoku a lot more, and Brian and Kathy were a little less on that one. This one, I think you guys liked a lot more than I did. Kath, tell us about Merchants of the Dark Road.
I liked this one a lot. Again, I loved the components.
I was going to say, I didn't talk aesthetics. So definitely
I really not. Liked the dice. They were just different and pretty. And I liked the theme. I liked, like, gathering the wares and fulfilling the commissions. And there were all different kinds of... Were they heroes? Is that what they were called? That you added to your...
Pretty sure they were heroes.
To your wagon. So there was the knight and the bard and the wizard. Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Awesome. Yeah, no, in certain ways it felt pretty restrictive in what you could do on, like, a specific turn, but I feel like that's kind of where you had to play through the whole game and kind of see, like, how the scoring would be affected by that. Like, I feel like the scoring is the thing that's going to make it, you know, kind of stand out a little bit more on its own, just because you do have to have that balance where you could, you know, like you have to do well on two different things about at the same pace, and it was just a cool game to dive into.
Yeah, the dice mechanism is really interesting how that works, and I actually agree with what you said. It's restrictive, but not in a frustratingly restrictive way, just in a, like, figure out the puzzle, figure out what you want to do, and totally agree on the scoring. Some of the games where it's like, oh, you get the lowest, right, and it's like, oh, I had 10 points here and 17 points here, so I get 10, but then there's 36 bonus points I get. But this had 5 bonus points, right? It was very low on that. Eric, have you seen this or played this?
I only saw you folks playing it. I haven't had a chance to play it myself.
All right. So that's Merchants of the Dark Road. Then we went back to our place. We found a circular table that almost fit this game 4-player, but we did manage to get a game in, and this is Corrosion. And I thank you to Clay and everybody over at Capstone because they gave me a copy so we could play through it. And also Brian picked up copies, which Kathy knows well because she carried them through the city of Philadelphia. So we've got copies for people. Corrosion is a game where you're trying to build engines and engine parts and eventually turn things into chrome because iron rusts and chrome doesn't. So you're trying to upgrade your gears and gather things. So basically, there's two mechanisms in the game. There's a hand of cards where you're playing your engineers. So your engineers come out, and you kind of have a wheel with 4 sections. Your current section has an X, and then there's like 1, 2, 3 going around. So if I play a level 3 engineer, she's going to be put in that 3rd section, and I'll have to turn my wheel over to there to get that card back. When I play that card, it's got a little like Lori Tyrone mechanism where everybody can choose to follow by playing a higher grade, which a higher number engineer of the same suit, and they can get whatever benefit I got. So most of that is like a drafting mechanism. You're drafting new engineers to go in your hands. You're drafting one-shot machines. You're drafting turning machines that will go off a certain number of times and give you resources, and then eventually trying to get these chrome engine parts by creating chrome gears. And the main resource in the game are these gears. They're small, medium, and chrome, and you spend those to make the different parts. The second action in the game I already alluded to, you turn the wheel on your board, and you do the actions in that location. So the turning machines, you always get their benefit. The one-shot ones, you get them if you've activated them and you turn to that section. And then the chrome ones, initially, they only go off when you go around 4 times, but as you upgrade them, they'll go off like almost every time you turn, so you can get a lot of victory points and other things out of those. There's also like a set of academy tiles that can be purchased, and those can give you points and like end game points that you can get. So there's a pile of victory points, kind of a la...
peanut butter sandwiches.
Race for the Galaxy peanut butter sandwiches.
A la peanut butter sandwiches.
There you go. And when that pile gets to, like, three or less, or the Academy tiles, then that will trigger the end of the game, and now people have to pay points to take additional turns, which we mostly didn't. Somebody took one turn?
I took one, because I had an easy move that I could complete for a few more points, so yeah.
To me, this is like a medium weight complexity for, like, learning the rules, but getting all that timing down is, like, a huge part of that first play. I'm not going to say we all enjoyed it, because I don't know if we did. I'm going to let people talk about the game. Kathy first.
I liked it. I didn't love it. That's it.
Awesome.
Yeah, no, I think this is one of the ones that I'm going to try to get to the table quickly with Rachel, with my wife, just because I feel like it's got a good system in it, and it would just be cool to see it, you know. Hopefully that reinforces the enjoyment that I had from the first play.
The impermanence of this game is an interesting factor. You've got a lot of resources that just disappear on you. You've got a lot of machines that are only one-time use or as many as three-time uses that are going to give you useful bonuses but not last for very long. The only things that are permanent, really, are the machine components, the final chrome components that are also not permanent, because if you build more than three of them, you cover them up. So you still get points for them, and that's the only real permanence there. You're not going to get to use those abilities forever, because you might cover them up with something else. So the game's a lot about churn. It's about finding the next thing that's going to keep your engine moving in more ways than one. And that, if you don't like that, if you like getting your stuff and keeping it and leveraging the stuff that you've earned and not having to replace it when it becomes obsolete, then this could be a frustrating experience. But if you're willing to go with the flow and be ready to replace things and look for your next opportunity, you have to be a little agile in this game to stay ahead of the curve and not leave yourself with nothing just because you set up for one big turn. You have to be looking ahead at what am I going to do in the next phase and still keep my options open. Then it's a cool challenge.
Yeah, that's impermanence is a great way. I didn't get to describe all that, and I thought you did a good job with that. I really enjoyed Corrosion. I am definitely looking forward to playing it again. I'm getting less averse with games where, like, the first play... Like, I feel like I get a lot more second plays in because I'm not playing as broad. Like, I'm not playing the 500 new games a year or whatever. That was Larry's thing, right? That one year he played 500 new games or whatever. But, you know, but in all honesty, I'm not playing 300 new games a year. I'm playing 75 to 100, so actually getting second plays. So this game, there was a lot of little, like, rule nuances or strategy nuances, like using the steam to be able to move parts up so they could trigger at the right time. And I didn't see that on the first play, and I see more of that. So I'm excited to go back and not make those strategic mistakes or have those as options. So I'm really looking forward to this neat game, neat theme, neat use of mechanisms. I do want to quickly mention that I got a chance to demo Tidal Blades 2, which is the new one from Skybound Games. Played this with James Hudson and a bunch of other people, and played through that, and that's exciting. This is not like Tidal Blades 1. It's the same universe, but it is a co-op dungeon crawl story progression campaign game. Lots of good connections to what was in the original one. And this is coming to Kickstarter 2/22/22. It's so easy to remember, I didn't even have to think about it. So there's that. All right. And then the last two games we're going to talk about, I think these are games that we all enjoyed. I don't know why I keep telling you guys what you thought of the games.
It helps us remember.
We're excited to talk about, I think might be a good part. So the first one is 1923. No mistakes there, so all I want to point out. Cotton Club. And this takes place in the Harlem District or Harlem section of New York City. And this is from Looping Games, which is a Spanish publisher. And they bring these kind of small box games based on historical events or time periods. So this one is like speakeasies and working with gangsters and trying to run your club and hire entertainment and get famous people to come in. It is a worker placement card drafting game where you're getting resources and money is the primary resource, spending that, and it's done through a series of rounds, and then there's kind of events that trigger throughout. Eric, you had recommended to us because you were the first to play, so you can be the first to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is about acquiring these symbols. You'll draft a particular card and then sort of tuck it under your board so that now your club serves whiskey or beer or wine, or you've hired an entertainer and they are good at jazz, or they play the saxophone, or they dance, or something like that. And it sort of filters down to acquiring these celebrities. And the more of the symbols that that celebrity wants that you have, the less expensive it is to get these celebrities. And the celebrities are the things that get you lots of points. But you're also trying to manage your infamy, I guess. You have sort of a mob level, how illegal, how much you're on the radar of the cops, and that can sometimes get you into trouble. Some of the events can reference guns, you know, the toughness of your muscle and your security, and if you don't have enough of those, you're going to get into trouble, lose money or lose points. But of course, the more guns you've got, the more notice, the more criminality you're going to have. You're also managing your initiative level, which affects turn order, and you're managing your fame. That's not quite what it's a megaphone on the track. How well you can popularity, your influence. That's it. How much you can attract stars and celebrities to your club. It's a lot to sort of juggle, but I really liked the choices. It felt tight. It felt interesting. The theme is cool, and plus some of those celebrities and artists are real people, which is kind of a cool little thing to get Ella Fitzgerald into your club. It was neat.
Yeah, no, I had fun. I think that's okay to say, right, Brent?
I'll approve it for this game.
No, it did feel like our play was a little bit out of whack, just because I got off to an early lead with a couple of the symbols, and it just, you know, kind of snowballed out of reach. But it was a fun system, and I think it would be a good one to play again.
I really liked the theme on the game. I thought that was really neat to do, like the whole gangsters, Harlem, like Eric had said, having real people from the time period in the game. So I just think, I guess I think of this game with the series of games. That's just such a key part, that they're doing all these games that are based on these historical time periods and not kind of the standard historical time periods that, you know, are always around. So that was really neat.
Well, we kept saying that for such a small box, there was a lot of game in there.
Yeah, for sure. We can call it Tiny Epic 1923. Oh, no, I think that's trademarked. All right, last game is Scout. And Eric, you did a really good job explaining this game. Can you explain Scout again? Do you mind?
I'd be happy to. Okay, so Scout is a ladder climbing game, which is one of those, not really trick-taking style, but one of those card games where you're playing sequences of cards, either singles or doubles, triples of the same value, or runs of various numbers of cards, and trying to beat whatever the set of cards is on the table. So if Brant played a pair, I could beat that by playing more cards, either a triple of a particular value, or a higher pair, or a triple or more of a run from my hand. I can't always do that with the cards that are in my hand, especially because of the rule in this game that does not allow you to rearrange the cards in your hand. Kind of like Bonanza, when you pick up your hand, they stay in that order. I can grab cards from anywhere in my hand, but they have to be next to each other when I play them. The cool thing is that the cards have two sides. So an eight, you might have an eight in your hand, but if you flip it over, it might be a three. And if you cannot play a card or a combination of cards to beat whatever's on the table, you can scout, which is acquiring one of the cards that is currently in the group of cards that's on the table from either end. So if it was a 4, 5, 6 on the table, I can't beat that. I could take the 4 or the 6, and I can put it anywhere in my hand, and I can put it in either orientation. So if the 4 also has a 7 on the other side of it, I can turn it around and stick that 7 somewhere in my hand. Now I've improved my chances for playing something in the future. That earns points for the person who played the set on the table to begin with, but it improves my options coming up. And the object is to get rid of your cards faster than your opponents. If you do that, you're not going to take negative points, and everybody else has to take negative points based on what they still have in their hand, but that's mitigated by cards that they've beaten by playing cool combinations, and points they've earned by other people scouting their cards. And this continues for a number of rounds, and most points wins. It's got a neat twist to this whole system. I've played a lot of ladder climbing games, and usually it's all about winning individual tricks. That's not what this is. Each hand, each deal of the cards is one long trick. A set of cards that's on the table will either be beaten, and those cards go into scoring, or they're going to be whittled down by scouting the cards that make it up. So it's all about making a particular combination stronger or weaker, and the can just continue, or the trick just continues until somebody runs out of cards, which is a cool twist.
Nice. Yeah, I'll go first here. I think I was the only one who liked this game, so actually, I scored poorly, and I think afterward I immediately went to that, like, what did I do wrong? Why am I not? But I just want to say, like, even saying that, I totally love the twist on this game and all that kind of stuff. I'm definitely interested in digging in more. I'm intrigued if just, you know, some hands are just going to be tougher to play out. Like, it's just going to be tricky to get through, and that was just a series. I never was able to go out, and everybody else went out, so I think that was just the differential in points, and that can just be a thing, right? The goal is to go out, and you never went out, so you didn't score a lot of points. Like, I think that's perfectly reasonable, but I think it's important knowing that, like, even though I scored the lowest, I really enjoyed that. Eric, great explanation. I wouldn't have been able to do that. You articulated that well. Brian, will pay him, right, for being on this episode?
I hope so.
Perfect.
We won't hit him with Unmatched.
Yes. Oh, he's Unmatched free. I'm not going to go around because this was kind of the last game we played, so just people can say thoughts on the game as they come to them.
I'm going to buy it. Oink Games is either just now releasing or should be releasing soon their version of it. We played the, I think, Taiwanese copy, but Oink Games has one that includes a two-player variant. Brant and Kathy might be interested in that. I am probably going to pick this up and throw it in a quiver or take it to family gatherings. I think it's going to be a hit.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it coming in at the store because it feels like an easy thing to just recommend to people coming in looking for a fast game to the table.
I really liked it. This was another one, again, with the crew. I was, like, raised on Setback, so I really love trick-taking games and card games. We played Bridge before. Like, I just like that kind of game. So I loved the twists on this kind of game, that the hand just kept going and the two-sided cards and the not arranged. Like, it was just, it, like, spiced it up, I guess. I don't know. It was fun. I really liked it.
Nice. So that is Scout. It'll be coming out from Oink Games, so you can scout out your local retailer for that game. That's like a way too direct pun, huh? All right, last thoughts, last feelings, last emotions. We're in the last town before we're home, and what did we think of PAX Unplugged 2021?
Yeah, no, it was great. The stacking game that we played to carry everything to the car was the most difficult one of all, but no, yeah, it was a great time. I was really happy to be there. We definitely missed Larry, but but it was, you know, hopefully everything will kind of get back for that for the next con. So, but yeah, it was great.
I had a great time. I had fun, and it was a blast. Really nice to see people again, get to play some games, just get some of that personal connection back a little bit. Hopefully this is the beginning of more big events to come. And like I said, PAX does it really well. I think this was a model for how to run things well. And other big cons could learn a lot from the team at PAX.
I really liked it. I had my doubts at the beginning because organizing getting away for this weekend this close to Christmas was intense. Finding childcare and all that stuff. So I wasn't sure that going into it that it was going to be worth it. But I'm glad I went.
Yeah, I had a blast. I love PAX Unplugged. I'll be super sappy, but I always say it's my favorite con because Kathy comes with me to this one. Aww. And it's just super fun to have her there and be able to play games with her and kind of enjoy, you know, hanging out with people and seeing people and introducing her to all the people that I get to play games with and interact throughout the year. Thanks to Eric for coming with us for the first time. It was awesome to have you.
I had a lovely time.
I hope Dice Tower never has a booth again so you can hang out with us every time because it was a total blast to have you with us. Thanks to Brian for paying all the bills.
Not all the bills.
No, thanks, Brian, for, you know, just letting us all be part of the store and the community that you created, because that's been a lot of fun. That's us for PAX 2021.
Are we home yet? I need to use the restroom.
We're super close, everyone. Stay in the back. Watch out for Unmatched.
Ow!
All right, everybody. That is it for this episode. I am the Brant, and on behalf of Brian, Kathy, and Eric, we hope until next time. Step into the portal. Bye, everybody. Bye.